Okay, so over the last few weeks, I try not to put on the theatre voice, gravitas. Over the past few weeks, we've been looking at Living Wisely by Sangharakshita, the founder of the Triratna Buddhist Order and Community. And it's his commentary on the Precious Garland Sutra by Nagarjuna. And there's another book in the series called Living Ethically, which is a commentary on a different part of the sutra, but it's part of the sutra that emphasizes ethics. And this particular book, as we've been finding out, emphasizes the wisdom practices and elements. And this week we're particularly looking at the third chapter, which is called Images of Emptiness. But I'm going to try and not make it so esoteric. If anything, I feel that even in the wisdom practices, we should be pragmatic. You know, we've heard that the Dharma, the Buddha's Dharma, the doctrine, is all method, all a way of practicing, all a way of moving actively towards enlightenment, to purifying our intentions, to refining our mind, to cultivating stillness, and on the basis of that, being able to see the way things really are. And before the break, I was just briefly leading us through a few reflections. I don't think they're traditional. I sort of made them up. So I don't think you'll find them in the Buddhist tradition. Well, you might find something similar. You'll find this model of the five skandhas. Skandhas meaning aggregates, or the things that come together. And particularly these skandhas refer to the things that come together to make up a human being. And they are form. We have form or body. We have feeling or sensations, or if you like to be posh about it, hedonic tone. We have perception. And within perception we have the faculties of the senses, the five senses and the mind. And then we have volition. We have our will. And finally, we have consciousness, which is sort of of which everything is held within, or everything is suffused by. It's probably better to say. And so that's what we're going to look at a bit tonight. This is the part of the chapter that's entitled "A Wheel of Fire." And it's particularly focusing on in a way, I think the previous chapters have dealt with the sense of egolessness or working towards egolessness in a very principial sense. And I feel that in this chapter, Bhante says, you know, it can be easy to think that the previous chapter, from the previous chapters, that it's all about the mind, and that the mind is located here. Yes, and you can get the idea that just as you can just work with your mind, and it'll all be all right. You know, you'll get there. Well, you might. and to a certain extent, that's true, but in this chapter it sort of says, but there's more. There's also other ways of approaching reality. There's other views that we hold about our being that need to be taken in, addressed and seen through, seen more deeply, seen more profoundly in our experience. In a way, it's saying this is what our experience is made up of. Yes, we have an experience of form, we have an experience of sensations, we have an experience of perception and volition, and we have an experience of consciousness, awareness. And experience is made up of and met by that. Yes? Are you with me so far? So, the opening part of this chapter says quite boldly that what we do is we misconceive what these skandhas, these aggregates are. We misconceive them. And I'll just read you one of the sort of midpoint chapters, midpoints in the chapter, where Bhante mentions this. So if you misconceive the five skandhas when you think of them as static or unchanging, instead of processes of continual flux and transformation, it is when you start to experience what is essentially a process as something static that the I comes into existence. Okay? So it's when we start to concretize our ideas about the body as me and not a process that the I comes into existence. When we start to think of feelings or sensations as mine, the I comes into existence, or mine comes into existence, and so on for the other five, for the other three, in fact, with the whole five skandhas. So as soon as we start to think of make our wants more fully, as soon as we start to entertain wants, I want or I don't want, the I comes into existence. As soon as we start to think of what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, all of these processes are, if we misconceive them, contribute to the I coming into existence. So how do we know that? How do we see that? How do we experience that? So if you try to fix something that's essentially a process, what happens? I mean, if we sort of think about the body, can we think about what happens? If we don't see the body as a process and we see it as static, and we don't only see it intellectually, we see it in the depths, in a visceral, instinctive way, that it's me or mine. Yeah. So what can happen in that situation?
Attachment and frustration.
Attachment, yes, and frustration. Yeah. So how do we experience me and mine and the body?
Just here.
Hmm.
Just here. Usually like this.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm angry, for example, usually just there.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. It's very visceral, and you get it almost the wrong way around. Mm. You feel it, so therefore it's how you're feeling.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. So that's an interesting point, isn't it? It's actually quite difficult to separate out these five processes, because they're all happening at the same time, almost in the same moment. Yes. So it's they're so interlinked and interdependent. So as soon as we start talking about the body, we start thinking of it in terms of our sensation, what we feel. Yeah. That's certainly my experience of, for me it's here, I notice it sometimes in meditation, when I start holding on, and, I usually start experiencing pain. I have a habit of developing a knot in my scapula. And if I allow that to develop and I don't release it, then it puts my neck out. And so there's this real sort of deep holding on that we can get into.
Does that come from childhood, though? Because when you're a baby, if you're hungry, it's a feeling of hunger. It's very basic. So you grow up through that. So if you fall over, you hurt. So it's like that hurts. My knee hurts. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And it all starts very baser. Those senses. Mm-hmm. So you get conditioned. To those senses, as being mine, and I'm feeling upset. When you're a kid, you're upset about something. Someone says something horrible to you. Mm. I'm upset. You don't understand why you're upset. You're just upset.
Mm.
So everything becomes internalized. Mm. And as you get older, because you're habitually doing that since you're a baby, you can't get beyond that unless you start thinking more consciously.
Mm. Mm. I think that's on the money, actually. It's exactly that process that we get into, the habitual repeating of particular patterns of experience or of knowing of particular processes, which we make more concrete by habitually engaging in views about them. So it's exactly that process. We engage in a process of fixing, of stopping, of making things more certain, usually in order to feel safe, usually in order to feel secure in our own skin. So we can fix things in the body, and sometimes we'll experience that holding on as discomfort. If we're not allowing energy to move, for example. I wonder whether also we can habitually notice particular sensations. I wonder if that's another example. Does anybody recognise a sort of tendency to notice certain types of sensations or feelings more exclusively than others? I know I certainly did that before I started to meditate. I think sometimes I use the example on the introductory courses as I'd sort of coast along on pleasant sensations and take them for granted. But the things that really caught my attention were the unpleasant ones. And I can sort of habitually notice. I'm sort of more inclined to notice the unpleasant ones. There might be others of us who are more inclined to notice the pleasant sensations and disregard the unpleasant ones or distract ourselves while they're going on. But we will be temperamentally inclined to notice one or other. And for large periods of my life, I noticed a lot of numbness, a lot of sort of entropy in sensation. So it's worth bearing in mind that that's a possibility too. So we can habitually, in a sense, cut ourselves off from the whole range of experience because we have a particular bias to notice particular sensations. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does that resonate at all?
But do you think there are particular ones, either positive or negative, that through whatever process or reason or explanation, we might just find ourselves forming stronger associations with? It's kind of what you're suggesting, isn't it? Mm. Which I can sort of go along with, I think. But without being able to fully explain why it's those particular feelings, that particular moment of stress or that particular moment of joy, I might associate more strongly with. Slightly mysterious.
Yeah. It's certainly a good word for it. it is more of the nature of mystery, and it's helpful to see it in that way. It's, in a way, it might even be limiting to question too deeply why, and just more helpful to notice that that's something that happens. And to notice that unfolding as we develop awareness through meditation and through the development of metta and awareness. Later on in the chapter, I'm going to jump about a bit, so just bear with me. I'll just say things as they come into my mind and they feel appropriate. Later on in the chapter, the Bhante does mention that the Buddha does not usually entertain questions about why does this happen. He just says that actually that will work itself out, and you'll come to see that as you develop awareness. He expresses a lot of metaphysical reticence around the questions of why. Particularly in regard to this type of conception of beings. So that he just says, if you practice, if you develop awareness, it will become clear why you. It's very difficult actually to jump into somebody else's mind in a way and understand why we develop particular affinities for particular experience, in a sense. We'll all have our own different reasons, our own unique reasons for doing that. So that might be part of the reticence.
Yeah. Almost as if there's something that's been kind of like squashed or tangled and is getting untangled. And that, as you're sort of noticing the bits and the way they're folded, you think, oh, that's strange, why is that? And then later on, maybe as it sort of pans out and unfold itself fully, it's not such an issue.
Yes, absolutely. That's a nice way of explaining it. Yeah. So a little while, so we can move on to perception. We can move on to perception. And we, each of us, will have a particular preferred sense. I'm just going to put that out there. Rather boldly, mine is hearing. You know, I'm much stronger at hearing than at anything else. Maybe because I'm conditioned to love music, and in fact, it's been a real distraction for me since childhood, being a music junkie, and I didn't realise until I was listening to a talk from Vidyadhaka, who's an artist, and he suggested we have habitual ways of seeing. And if you think about that, actually that's quite true. It really woke something up in me that only really started to come clear the next retreat I did, when I noticed that the acuity and the range of colour and the level of detail that I could entertain in my vision increased as my awareness increased. And I wonder if that led me on to wonder whether we all have that sense of bias in our experience for a particular sense, a sense faculty, you know, whether it's taste, particularly if we're cooked. You know, it might be taste, you know, hearing if we're very into music, visual sense if we're into art, if we're a master, it might be the sense, the feeling touch, the actual sense of touch. Or it might be, you know, mind if we're a psychologist, or whatever. And I'm just sort of putting stuff out there, but I think the important point is to recognise that we can underplay some of our senses. We can leave them underdeveloped as we have a particular bias for a particular sense. But they all get developed as we develop awareness. And you could say, you know, we use phrases like selective hearing, don't we? Yeah. Oh, he hears very selectively on that subject. Or she only sees what she wants to see. Or whatever. And I think there's truth in that. There's truth in that because we gravitate towards that which we find pleasurable and dismiss that which we don't find pleasurable.
My wife's got that.
So in this sense of habits, what the Buddhist view would be is that we limit ourselves in these ways by leaving particular senses undeveloped, and it can be a way of limiting the degree of awareness that we develop. So there can be a practice even in emphasising the development of a particular sense faculty, to draw it out, to cultivate it more. Yes, and then in volition, well, it comes down to moving towards or moving away from liking or not liking, and gosh, we're really good at that. That's to paraphrase Kevin Bacon, a no-brainer, isn't it? But all of these things are some things that reflect habit, that reflect a certain narrowing or limiting of experience in our particular being. Does that make sense? Yeah? So, yes. And I think the collective sort of habitual identification with all of these processes has a narrowing effect on consciousness, has a narrowing effect on the mind, on the amount of experience that we're prepared to entertain, or the breadth of experience that we can engage with and be happy with even. So let's just pause there and see how that sits, or if there are any questions about that.
I sort of think that in a way my biases and prejudices are sort of endless.
Mm.
Like I don't even know kind of the scope of them, and that does obviously limit my ability to use my senses.
Mm. 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 Yeah. So how did the reflections work for you before the break? How did they... was there a particular reflection that resonated?
Sorry, go for it. Yeah, I mean, about impermanence, when you were saying how everything changes, even your mind, your thoughts, mm. your perspectives and beliefs, even those change. And it's something I just discovered this year. It's something I always knew deep down, but...
Mm.
It's something that I only properly acknowledged this year.
Mm.
So yeah, it brought to the question like, who are you? When, well, because I was someone who very much defined myself on what I believed.
Mm.
So when your beliefs change, it's like, who are you?
Mm. Mm. So that sense of that we can very strongly identify with beliefs,
yeah,
we can have a lot of emotional investment in them,
yeah,
and then when they change, we think, what have I been doing? Mm. Or, you know, what is my life about? Mm. What is giving meaning to my life if I can't rely on that? Mm. And in a certain way, we can end up feeling quite baseless or groundless sometimes if something arises which shakes those beliefs. Or we can respond angrily when somebody challenges them, if we are very attached to them and feel very strongly about them, can't we?
Yeah.
So in a way, that's a clue that we're particularly attached and strongly attached when our beliefs are challenged, and somebody doesn't agree with, or has a different perspective, a way of knowing we're attached, is that we respond angrily or we get irritated. So that's a really important clue for development.
When you become mad, right? I've seen you become ambivalent though as well.
Mm. Mm. Can you say more?
Fear that, well, is anything then going to matter?
Mm.
You're so accepting. Good and bad is going to come, it's going to change. What fear that it leads to ambivalence?
Mm. Mm. So. If we do, so let me just make sure I've understood you correctly. If we do let go of views and things we feel are important, what's left is the question.
Exactly. What's important?
Mm.
And what do you cling to?
Mm.
What do you hold on to?
Mm.
What is nothing? The sense of everything becomes unimportant.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, if we can see the not that things are without substance, but those things are continuously changing, and we can see that in ourselves we are not fixed entities, but agents of change and growth and development, yes? Then the capacity for growth and development becomes limitless. We don't limit ourselves or narrow ourselves in a particular way. But what also happens is that we can more readily identify with a broader range of people. We can more readily identify with the essential humanity that we all share. The essential struggles and the quest for meaning. And so suddenly we have much more in common than we did ever before with the whole of humanity. And the natural response to that is love and compassion, or connection, or engagement.
You can empathise with people more.
Hmm. So what comes in to that opening out is a sense of connection and engagement, and a knowing of the interconnectedness of all things. And out of that sense of interconnectedness comes a sense of wonder, even beauty. Does that answer the question? That's what feels to me happens. Yeah.
But it's true.
You're saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When it's with rapists and dictators and torturers, mm-hmm. where does that leave you? I mean, I think that's a mind blowing idea, and something maybe that I can also. I think sometimes I've experienced.
Mm.
But it does feel like it leaves you a bit mapless. Mm. And you don't quite on boundaries in terms of right and wrong. And, you know, it's very painful to old ideas of what you used to think were right.
Mm.
I feel under attack sometimes by those connections.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you think for yourself?
Yeah, I think it's worth it. I do think it's worth it. Even if I don't have a... I don't have a world view anymore. Which is difficult.
I had an interesting experience once with my mother visiting and spending time around my mother-in-law.
Uh-huh.
And it was so awkward, and it was just like two people completely different in every single possible way. I had a really strong meditation practice at the time, and all of a sudden something broke through. I could see that they both wanted exactly the same thing, and they couldn't, and they were completely, I don't know if I'm explaining this. It was very bizarre to sort of see through all of that and all of their resistance to each other and see that they actually just wanted exactly the same thing. And I sort of, it was emotional sort of feeling actually. I remember sort of shedding tears and thinking, wow, they just want the same things, don't they? Completely different people from completely different conditions, different sides of the world even, and coming together and very awkward and uncomfortable, and you could just see it.
So there's that sense of actually we're all trying to get needs met somehow. We might go about that unwisely, sometimes in a very damaging way. But we all work from where we are, at the level that we are at, and we can only take the next step for us in terms of practice. And yes, it may seem that people do incredibly odd things in the pursuit of getting their needs met, and we just don't understand them. And in a way, that's really the biggest challenge, is to stay with that sense of openness whilst not understanding how people try and get their needs met. But in a way, as we develop awareness, as we develop our capacity for openness and clarity and refinement in mind, as Nyanavacha was saying at break, that sense of what we most value comes through strongly, orientates us more clearly as the level of awareness develops. And it becomes clear where we're going, or at least we trust where we're going. We won't always know why we trust it in a certain way, but it feels right. It feels right. Yes, maybe I'll leave it on that cliffhanger for a moment.
I did want to mention something about in relation to what you said over there about, you know, do I feel indifferent about injustice that goes wrong on around the world? And the answer I would say is that you don't. But the thing, it's like with yourself, you depersonalize it in the sense that you acknowledge the things that are going on. You don't become detached from everything that's going on. You see things that are going on that are bad, but you realise that there are bad things happening, but you don't say that a person is permanently evil. A person is the result of the things that they've done and what other people have done to that person. So you don't say that, oh, that's a bad person, it's like a person doing bad things at this point in time.
Absolutely. So we'll move on a little bit and read a little bit more of Bhante's commentary and see where this takes us. So when you try to arrest the flow, when you try to make what is dynamic into something static, You cannot prevent that dynamic process from going on, but you set up a patterning that gives the appearance of stasis. The continuing repetition of that pattern is what we call rebirth. Action that results in rebirth is habitual reaction rather than creative action. It expresses only the limitations inherent in that pattern. And the repetition reinforces the tendency to go on repeating the pattern. I.e., rebirth means repeating old patterns and putting off being truly creative. So. So how does that leave us? The big word rebirth in there, isn't it?
I struggle with the word creative. Because I hear it a lot. Because I teach art, it's just in my head, synonymous with being creative in terms of visually creative. But what do we mean by being creative? Because I understand the habitual conditionings that you were talking about before before the end word creative sort of leaves me a bit flummoxed.
So the question is, what do we mean by creative? Do you want to have a go at it, or for what it means for you?
No, I mean. For me, like I said, it just means being a creative person, and sort of like creating that lotus picture, whatever, which I think is beautiful. A creative mind would be something, creating something. I just struggle with that.
So, the movement in Buddhist sense, in Buddhist practice, is a movement away from habitual ways of relating to the world, to experience, to ourselves, to everyone, to more creative ways of engaging or responding. So we talk about it in terms of moving from reacting to responding. So we've talked about it in terms of meditation, in terms of it creating that space where you can choose your responses. You can see the tendency to react to a particular thing that's come in, to your experience, but you think, there's other options here. There's choice here in this space, and I can choose a response. So that would be an example of being creative. The idea or the actual practice of seeing that there's more than one possibility in a situation where you've caught the tendency that you want to react, but you do something differently because you choose a response rather than react. So that's one example of being creative. So rather than circling around in that habitual tendency of this is what I do always in this situation, you broaden out the range of possibilities where you then think, what will be most helpful in this situation is not for me to kick the person who's just kicked me, but to stop and ask why, or choose another option. You see what I mean? So it's not that reactive tendency. So another way of looking at creativity? Or maybe I'll just open it up, actually. Do other people have a sense of what would be creative for them? What do we mean by this principle of creativity?
I have more feeling than actually words, but for me, being creative means to be true me. To, as you were talking about, not reacting, but responding, or just acting without fears, acting without being attached to some needs. Makes sense.
I have something similar to that. I think about acting freshly. So, like, instead of acting in the same old way, I act in a fresh way. It takes a lot of energy, though, to do that. Like, you've got to, it's not an easy thing to keep on thinking, how can I, well, not like in a forced way, like, how can I be different this time? But, like, actually, am I just responding like I usually do? Usually, when things get difficult, that's when it's the most difficult to.
People could talk of reverting to type, don't they? in difficult situations. And I think what they mean is responding habitually. Whereas, so in some situations, you know, we, even though it might be quite demanding to respond differently, we're cultivating a breadth in our response, in our capability. In a sense, we're flexing that creativity muscle, as it were, that sometimes needs a little bit of work, sometimes is actually spontaneous. It's arising out of the fullness and richness of experience that's suffused with awareness and metta. I know it always seems that we come back to mindfulness and metta, but they are indispensable. They are indispensable as developed qualities and practices, and they do take you all the way. What happens is they just become more and more alive, more and more present. And in that space, there's more possibility. And there's an openness. You could say creativity is openness. You could say creativity has a tendency to spiral upwards and outwards rather than to circle inwards and narrowly, which would be the reactive response. And creativity does involve the imagination, but it doesn't involve the imagination in the way that we think. So it's not about being an autistic person, for example. It can be that we're just creative in communication. We're good at using our intuition, even. Or we're creative in a sense that we can work through difficulty with equanimity. We can hold our purpose and our positivity in the face of real challenges. These are all examples of what is considered creative. Does that make sense?
Would you equate creativity with wisdom?
I think there is wisdom in it. Yes, I think you can say it's a foreshadowing of real wisdom. And actually, it can be wisdom itself, where a selflessness is present.
I sort of get the experience of creativity mostly around things where, like, if I decide to be, I'll just take an example. I decide at work I'm not going to talk about people behind their back at my work, and then if somebody comes and starts talking about somebody else behind their back, and I know and I remember that I'm not going to get involved in it, just by that sort of guarding against that, then something else comes out, and I didn't predict it or anything. I don't know how I'm going to react, but I know that I'm not going to do that. and then something else happened, and I didn't decide. Oh, what I'll do is I'll do this when they say it. Just by guarding against that one thing, something else arises which I didn't predict.
Mm. So it took you into a more creative space.
Yeah.
It's quite powerful for the other person, isn't it? Because I've been in that situation. You know, people try to start gossiping with me, and I won't have anything to do with it, but I won't actually say anything. I just won't get involved. It's quite powerful for the other person, sort of. It's like, oh, right, he's not reacting. You know, he's not getting involved. Which sort of makes them think a little bit about what they're doing.
So it's sort of it. What you just said reminds me of something that came up for me on the ordination retreat, and it's this notion that while we're not reacting, it doesn't mean that we're disengaged. In fact, it means that we're fully engaged in the situation, both with the person, the situation at hand, and our experience of it. And in that moment, actually, it's very difficult to distinguish where I am in that, yeah, because there's such a degree of openness and engagement in the situation at hand. And this is the piece which is most creative. So when we're reacting, we're over-identified with ourselves or polarized to a view which reinforces our sense of self. And when we're not reacting, when we're responding or fully engaged, we're actually outside, open, not outside ourselves, but actually in a different place altogether. It's sort of like a different self is alive in the situation. So the sort of path is one of full engagement, but not over-identification. And you can apply that to any of these five domains of being. The notion of full engagement, but not over-identification. So if we can be fully engaged, we can see the processes unfolding and developing and playing out in their fullness, in their wonder. And yet, we're not trying to limit them or narrow them in any way by holding on to them, by over-identifying with them. And what it leads into is a breadth and openness of being. And a sense of a lessening of the I, or the me, or the mine, and the ego. And, my goodness, we've got 4 minutes. So we'll just skip to the end of this section. And have an image of that. So, no, it isn't Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or what have you. It's a closed hand. And one of the images in this chapter is one of a closed hand as a metaphor for the ego. And then that. As a metaphor for egolessness, with, you could say, when we over-identify with the five skandhas, with form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness, we have that. And when we start to fully engage, but not over-identify, we have that. And this is, in a sense, a bit of a koan. Does the closed hand exist in the context of the open hand? does the ego disappear when you open out? Or was it even there in the first place? But what truly is there is the potential for openness, in full engagement and letting go into spaciousness, openness, beauty, wonder and mystery. So, we have to finish there, I'm sorry. And we haven't even touched on about a 90th of the chapter. But never mind, that was really engaging. Really interesting. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next week with Subhadramati doing Fear of Fearlessness.